seems that the the mere way that the Buddha talked about is something which is very elusive and has kind of different ways of thinking about it. When I was reminded of one way when I was at Nan Lin and we had to go to the stupa, which was on the end of this extremely narrow ridge, and just sort of fell off on both sides, and I was thinking, wow, you've got to be careful about the middle way here. If you deviate from it, then you're going to be in big trouble. And so in one sense it's quite narrow, but in another sense it was quite a kind of broad and even path, so you know, you could still walk it quite comfortably. But you do have to be careful about falling off the ends. It does seem very it's very 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 difficult to really maintain that sense of middleness and balance in what we're doing, and to remember that middleness is a dynamic quality. It's not a static quality, so that as soon as it's defined or experienced in static terms, then almost certainly it will be betrayed very soon. And hence the story that I've told before, the Buddha and Mara standing watching the man walking along, and the man was walking along and he suddenly saw a piece of the truth lying on the ground in front of him. And he smiled, he bent down to pick it up. He was so happy he found the truth lying on the ground. He picked it up. And when he did that, then Mara smiled. And of course you've got this thing in the suttas where, you know, when the Buddha smiles when something mysterious happens that you don't understand, and Mara of course always gets depressed about being defeated. But in this case, Mara smiles, and the Buddha says, "Mara, that man just found the truth. Why are you smiling?" And Mara says, "Oh, just give him a minute. He'll make a doctrine out of it." Mm-hmm. And so that's how fine that line is. And it was, you know, it's always interesting when you traveling and then experiencing the different kinds of Buddhism that are being practiced, as I was just in Taiwan, and you see how different people practice in different ways, and that has different kinds of effects. And those effects are both positive and negative, and it seems that you can't avoid that. So one of the things that we have to learn as we grow up, in a sense, is we have to learn about the fallibility of Buddhism. And that parallels exactly what happens to us when we grow up as children, and when we're young children, we think that our mum and dad know everything and that they're always right. And then after a while, you realize that actually they make mistakes too, and that they're not always right. And so that's one of the very hard lessons to learn when growing up. And so it's the same with Dhamma. You have to realize that your teachers are fallible, and that the ways that Buddhism or Dhamma becomes embodied in a time and place will always be unsatisfactory. And after a while you begin to kind of discern some of the patterns and make kind of correlations between different kinds of teachings and so on. For example, there was an interesting correlation between a certain teacher who likes to teach what they call non-dual teachings, and Advaita Vedanta, or he's not a Vedantist, but influenced by that. He's a Buddhist teacher, but kind of influenced by that direction. And this, of course, to me, at Advaita, has always been a kind of absolutism. It sort of postulates some kind of absolute reality, to which ordinary reality is subject. And it always seems to me that this kind of doctrine is basically inherently totalitarian, and the political extension of that will be some kind of totalitarianism, such as believing in the kind of the absolute divine right of kings or something like that. And it was interesting that this particular teacher who I had known of teaching these kinds of doctrines many years ago, you know, actually was showing these kinds of tendencies on a kind of political or social level. And I thought that was quite interesting that correlation was there. It's not something which is inherently obvious. It's not something which is necessary. It's not always going to be the case that happens, but there's a tendency there. And so you start to notice these, there's like the positive and the negative space, because as soon as you do something positive, as soon as you say something, you point to something, even if that's the truth, then it's like you're shining a torch or shining a light on a part of reality, and then that immediately focuses attention on that part of reality, and of course makes one ignore the rest of reality. And of course reality is very big, and human words and concepts are very small, so that we can only ever hope to really indicate or describe certain bits of the truth using our words. It's simply too much of it. And so we have to be very careful how we choose that and how we structure that, because there will inevitably be this other side of what we're doing. And that's something that's very important to think about. It's not just what you're saying, but also what you're not saying. just to give a very ordinary, everyday example, this is one of the criticisms that the people in the conventional medical realm have of alternative medicines. That the alternative medicines which are prescribed not only don't work, but they also stop, but more importantly, that they stop people from taking the actual medicines that will help them. I'm not saying this criticism is correct. I'm saying that this is just an example of the kind of argument which I'm pointing to, or the kind of situation that I'm pointing to. If you take the herbal medicines, that means you're not taking the other kind of medicine. And so there's two sides to that, but we only tend to see the one side. We tend to see the positive side, the side that's actually illuminated, and to ignore the side that's not illuminated. And similar kinds of problems, you know, like when one of the ladies who was on the retreat, and again, you kind of learn to expect these kinds of things after a while on the kind of circuits. And this lady had been to one of these very intensive retreats a number of years ago, and while on the retreat had some kind of breakdown or something, and was still just barely recovering from her chronic headaches and tension and so on 5 years later, part of which was associated with the retreat, but also at the same time on the retreat she was told, because this lady had earlier in her life had an abortion, and she was told that if she didn't become a stream enter in this very life, that she would go to hell. And so she's extremely traumatized by this whole thing. And so this was sort of told to her at this time when she had this very intense meditation thing, and so she's got this incredible pressure in her mind that she's just got to become a stream enterer. And she's terrified of this, taking it very, very seriously. And, you know, I really had to... And what was interesting was that she didn't say anything to me at all about this during the retreat, until right at the end, and even after we'd finished, and it was just on the last night and everyone had gone, and then she said, oh, can I just ask you something? And then she started talking about this and actually revealing what the actual problem was. And of course I had to explain to her that this was not the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha never said anything like this. And that I had to teach her the simile of the spoonful of salt, that even if you've done something bad, like a spoon of salt in a glass of water tastes very salty. But if you put the same spoonful of salt into a lake of fresh water, then you can hardly taste it. And so if one's doing a lot of good deeds and making merit, then one doesn't need to fear going to a bad destiny. And of course, as the Buddha said precisely on this topic to Mahanama, Ma Bahayi Mahanama, Ma Bahayi Mahanama, do not fear Mahanama, do not fear. It's impossible. Cannot happen that somebody who's for a long time been developing virtue and generosity and so on should then go to a lower realm. And but interesting to see these kinds of effects, and I'm sure those effects are always there and we would not tend to see them. So this lady perhaps would tend to not see the teachers in the tradition where she heard these things. I mean, obviously she's been very traumatized and would be reluctant to go and seek more trauma from them. So, and that's a very good warning for all of us, you know, if we're teaching or sharing Dhamma to people, that if we say something which is hurtful or harmful, maybe inadvertently, maybe, you know, of course, you know, if you come back and you look at the intention of that, when that person said that to her, obviously his intention was to say, well, you know, abortion is no good, and to encourage women not to have abortion. So I think that's fine from a Buddhist perspective. Yes, of course, we should be encouraging women to not have abortions. But then to use such an extreme example, and so it's the extremism of it which is the problem. And like in Sri Lanka also, when one of the senior bhikkhus there, one of the Mahanayaka Theras, told the bhikkhunis that if you restart the bhikkhuni order when it's disappeared, then you go to hell. And so some of the bhikkhunis were so traumatized by this that they also went quite, cracked and went mad. Because this was a very respected monk. I said these kinds of things. And when I heard this story, I was so appalled. I was told this story by this young, very intelligent young Sri Lankan monk. And I said, well, how can he possibly say this? And he's just like, well, it's Theravada. It was a one-word sufficient explanation to to show what was going on. But the important thing is what is that? To always kind of reflect, like, what is that negative space? Like, what is the other side of everything that we're doing? And when we're teaching, you know, we maybe teach something, but what are we... We're pointing to one thing, we're aware of what we're pointing to, but what are we pointing away from? What are we leaving in the shadows? What is there in the twilight zone? What is there that we're not comfortable to express? What is there that we feel like if we were to look at it and address it and express it, that it would open up a can of worms, or worse? And so, how are we creating our own dark sides, our own blind spots, through teaching in this way? These are things I think are very important to reflect on, both on a practical level within our own meditation, our own practice, and also in terms of the way that we share Dhamma and speak with other people, to be very careful of these kinds of things. And one of the sayings, that I learnt from my dad, of course, the three great Dhamma teachings I learnt from my dad. One was, don't boil your cabbages twice, which is very good advice, especially for people working in the kitchen. Just remember that. That particular piece of advice that has no transcendental dimension to it. It's purely a piece of practical advice. Don't boil your cabbages twice. What was the other one? Oh, that's right. Thought. The nature of thought I learned about from my dad. Because whenever I'd do something wrong, I'd say, but I thought, and Dad would say, you know what thought did? Thought wet his bed and thought his brother did it. So this is my teaching on the nature of thought, and that particular aphorism has remained true since all of my Buddhist studies and philosophy and things like that. That one still stands as a good summary of the nature of thought. And the third one was a quote from some philosopher or something, was a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And of course he said that given my propensity to think that I'm an expert, having picked up one or two nuggets of information about something. And it's very true. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. We think we know. And when we think we know, then we will, we tend to lock reality in. We tend to determine reality according to these pre-existing concepts which we believe are correct and final. That tendency in philosophy they call positivism, which is nothing to do with the idea of positive thoughts or positive psychology, but it's the idea of being able to create definite and or be able to conceptualize a definite and final truth in a fixed form, this kind of tendency. And so this is one of the things that I think is very useful in postmodern philosophy, is that they've kind of demolished this idea of positivism and tend to emphasize the uncertainty of knowledge rather than always trying to find certainty. And you know, in some cases there is certainty, in other cases there isn't. And acknowledging the uncertainty, the issue is that acknowledging the uncertainty leads to more wisdom than insisting on a spurious certainty. Okay, and this is something which is always very good to keep reflecting on, about what do we actually know, why do we know it, what's the basis for it, what's the evidence for it. And this was one of the reasons why it was so, you know, it was quite shocking almost, and to see this talk, especially the talk by Alison Goodwin at this conference, where she actually, you know, used evidence to back up her arguments. And you know, it's almost like a shock to realize how rare that is, and how we give talks and so on Buddhism, and we hear teachings and all of these kinds of things. And when was the last time that you heard a Dhamma teacher who actually thought that it was a responsible thing to do to actually present empirical evidence to support what they were saying, or to give reason to what they're saying? And you know, it was interesting to compare the way that she did that with, say, the way that things are often done in traditional Buddhism. And then, for example, I was on the Metta retreat, and we're teaching about Metta, and like one of the things in Metta, it says you shouldn't develop Metta for somebody of the opposite sex. And so again, this is a kind of a classical positivist thesis: don't develop Metta for somebody of the opposite sex. And because you might end up being sexually attracted to it. Now, that particular piece of advice is based on a thing in the Visuddhimagga, and I wanted to just check it out and sort of reread it, and it sort of gave the story of a particular fellow who was meditating in his meditation room next to his bedroom, and then his wife was sleeping or something in the bedroom, and he developed metta for her, and then he just sort of kind of went mad, and he ended up bashing the wall down. He used this kind of idiom in Pali that he was beating on the wall the whole night, as if he was trying to bash his way through his wall to get to his wife. And so this is like the locus classicus of that particular idea. So when meditation teachers say you shouldn't develop metta for the opposite sex, this is the passage that we're referring to. But it's interesting to just reflect on what that passage is saying. First of all, I mean, it doesn't sound like the fellow was particularly, I mean, if we take it literally, it doesn't sound like he was a particularly kind of balanced individual. I mean, I honestly don't think that developing metta for somebody is going to sort of drive you into a kind of raging frenzy of lust. I mean, yes, I can understand why it would, you know, maybe be conducive to the arising of lust and maybe be something to be careful of, but to be kind of driven by this passionate frenzy because you think, oh, may your wife be happy, I find that a little bit, I mean, it's a great story, and you can understand why it's there as a story, but, I mean, if it happened, then, I don't, but then that becomes taken as an example to use for all time, so maybe it is an example that actually happened, or, you know, maybe a slightly exaggerated story of actually something that happened. And maybe it sort of happened and then somebody used it as an example and a meditation teacher heard about it and then they used it as an example and so on. It got repeated a few times and then gets collected by Buddhaghosa, put in the Visuddhimagga, and then it becomes holy writ and it becomes, you know, that's true in all places for all time. And so, you know, and of course it constructs a world of ideology. For example, it constructs a world of ideology where everybody's straight. So, you know, then so people were asking about this, you know, should you, you know, can you develop metta for people the opposite sex? I said, well, you know, you've kind of got various kinds of dimensions of sexuality, so whoever, you know, you may or may not feel lustful for depends on your own particular orientation. And so, you know, this category is constructed, which actually is probably, you know, embodies some good advice. Okay, so it's probably like a useful thing to bear in mind there, that metta, when the mind is not pure, and if you're developing metta in an intense way, then it can kind of slip off from being a kind of a love which wants to give and to share happiness. And it can slip off into something which wants to derive gratification. And so these things are kind of mixed up in our consciousness. They're not clearly distinguished in the kind of the ordinary emotional soup which is sort of flowing around inside our brains. And so you have to sort of be careful of it and purify the mind before that happens. So that's, you know, it's a good piece of advice, but it then gets interpreted in this very kind of positivist way, and that's just one very small example of the kind of thing that I'm talking about. So then, of course, when we apply that within our own practice, we have to be very more nuanced about it, and more flexible. And when you're speaking with people, you realize everybody has very different responses to their meditation, and so. You know, when I was describing doing metta meditation, and I said, okay, you know, second person, you do a love person. First of all, somebody who you won't feel sexually attracted to, and somebody who you feel very simple and unconflicted emotions with, okay. And so you feel like, you know, a childlike, pure kind of love for this is a good person for the second person, and so. You know, very emphasized this and repeated it a number of times, and then after a few nights, somebody said, "Can I use the same person for the second, the loved person and the hated person, which is my wife, because I love her and I hate her at the same time?" Okay, no, you can't. so it kind of, so you can see how the kind of, I think you don't know how you can kind of share these things, and then every time you do it, and it sort of gets taken off and taken into another direction. And so this, and another big problem, which I think is very serious issue to be understood well in our current climate, is just the existence of lots of so many different meditation techniques. And it is interesting to reflect that this is very different from the normal way in which meditation would be communicated. Traditionally, if you were, say, living in a village society, which most of the Buddhist countries have been rural-based societies, either living in a village level or perhaps in an urban level, but with a much more localized center. So you would kind of go to your local monastery, and either as a, you know, if you're ordained, you're ordained there, and you know, you might wander around from place to place. There was a certain degree of wandering, but also there would be a degree of stability, so that your kind of knowledge of meditation would be more or less picked up through teachings over the years, either as a layperson or as a monastic. And so you wouldn't have this kind of thing of learning a particular system of meditation at a, you know, defined time of having a retreat, but you would kind of gradually pick it up during your lifetime and discuss it with people and receive feedback on various things. And so it was a much more organic process. And so there wouldn't be, there's not so much you know, room for conflict as there is as soon as you develop this idea of a meditation system, which is a 20th century invention. Then you have a kind of defined set of stages and different practices and the relation between them, and then of course that will always conflict with everybody else's meditation system. And so this is a big problem, I think, that I think many people face. It's never been particularly an issue for me, because when I started meditating, I tried out a few different things, and then I tried Ajahn Chah Chah's practice, and I just really liked it, so I just kept doing that, and I just haven't been particularly interested in learning, you know, going and learning lots of other meditation techniques, whether they're good or bad or whatever is not the point, but just, you know, it's not really necessary. But for many people, this has been a big problem. And so again, you know, the problem of positivism sort of creeps in there, that one particular meditation technique is determined as being the correct one, and others are incorrect, defined relative to that. So sometimes in some places you can only do the kind of the in-house meditation, you can't do other meditations and these kinds of things. So it is interesting to notice how the little learning is a dangerous thing idea comes here, because we tend to have ideas about this meditation system is right or that meditation system is wrong and so on, without having actually practiced them ourselves or seen the benefits, and also without having empirical evidence for it. And you know, as far as I know, there's very little that's being done in sort of really deeply assessing the effectiveness of different approaches to meditation. I mean, we have kind of informal feedback and awareness through doing the retreats and so on, so you see how people go, and so you assess it intuitively. But there's a lot that doesn't tell you. And so again, you know, the kind of the negative space, maybe I do a meditation, maybe I do my metta meditation, I'm very happy with that, and I kind of sit down and I go, may I be happy, and I feel good, and I think this meditation's going very well. But what I don't know is, well, what would happen if I was doing another method? Maybe if I was to do Anapana or Four Elements meditation, maybe it would go better. I don't know. Or maybe if I was to do, you know, Goenka technique or something, then my meditation would go faster. And I can never know that. I can never know all of those things. I can never know all of those techniques. So this, we have to keep this level of humility about our own practice and a level of openness. So it always seems to me that this is much more of a sign of a very positive spiritual sign was this that kind of attitude is much seems to be much more important and much more representative of a sincere attitude towards a spiritual practice than is the what position we take. And so I was very impressed with the nuns from Nanlin, and we were talking about Vinaya, and I think I mentioned this last night, but when we were talking about a particular issue on Sikkhamana training, and I said, you know, I'm not really sure, you know, even if we show that the Sikkhamana period, I don't think was part of early Buddhism, I don't think that they wanted the all women to do the Sikkhamana training. But even if we can show that that was true at a certain stage, then if the existing Vinayas, at least some of them, do assume that the Sikkhamana training was essential for all women, you know, maybe that should be the way it's done in those traditions anyway, just out of respect for the tradition. And so I said it's not obvious which way should be taken. And they were very clear, and they said, no, if you can be shown that this is what's reasonable, and that this is what the, you know, if the evidence is convincing, then we'll just follow what the evidence says. And so, to me, again, it shouldn't be, but it was quite startling, and very different from most of the things that I've ever heard, certainly in our tradition, in the Ajahn Chah tradition. I really can't imagine people saying that in our tradition so openly. It's just not the kind of thing that you hear. I mean, yes, you do hear those kinds of things about more minor things, you know, like eating pineapple flavored lollies in the afternoon. I think I'll just give the background of that one. And the Buddha said, I allow all kinds of fruit juice. And the commentary says, oh yes, all kinds of fruit. No, the Buddha said, I allow all kinds of fruit juice except for fruit juice made from grains. Okay? And so then the commentary says, yes, grains are a great fruit, and so any other kinds of large fruit are also included. So you can't have pineapples and watermelons and things, watermelon juice and so on. So in Thailand they say you can't have pineapple juice. So this is all, of course, all the things which are widely available and easy to make juice out of. Right? So you're quite happily allowed to make juice out of bananas or mangoes or something, which you can't actually juice anyway. But watermelon or pineapple you can't make juice out of. And they even take it so far that if you have sweets, which are allowable, but if they're artificial pineapple flavoured, right, then you can't have them. Okay? I remember Ajahn, someone raised this life and death issue at one of the drinks times, in the evening drinks, at Dao Dung, and Ajahn Pasano just said, that's not Vinaya. So, and that kind of attitude does exist. It is possible to deal with it, but it is interesting that, you know, for another issue that happened along those lines was when we had some Mechi who were staying at Pudumkong with us, and they had been, one of them was Ajahn Liam's sister, who had been one of the Mechis when Ajahn Chah was there, and she had this thing about scraping all of the seeds out of the tomatoes before offering them. So if ever you had like raw tomatoes in the salad or something, instead of guppying them, she'd actually go through and actually like hollow out all the tomatoes and throw all the seeds away, because you couldn't offer the tomato seeds. And we kind of were curious about why she was doing this, and Ajahn Pasano again asked her, and she just said, oh, well, I think she said that the head nun at Wat Pa Pong said that this was what Ajahn Chah said to do, or it was what they did in Ajahn Chah's day or something. So Ajahn Pasano said, oh, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to challenge this tomato scraping doctrine. That's just going to be too much of a can of worms to open that one, so leave that. So we had our hollowed out tomatoes for the rest of the range retreat. And it is to me, looseness, this kind of flexibility that we can get in our mind, which is very open to experience and very open to understanding the truth. And I think this is particularly crucial at the stage of developing insight, developing vipassana in meditation. And if we have too much of a fixed and definite view about what vipassana consists of, then I'm afraid, again, I can't prove this, okay, so I haven't got empirical evidence for this, but I fear that you can actually be knocking your mind off from truth. And this is certainly what seems to happen in the sciences and academic sphere generally, when there's too much of a concern and acceptance for truth which has already been codified and already been realized, then there's a little possibility for new insights into the truth. But it seems to me that the crucial thing about deep vipassana, it's not actually what you know. I mean, we all know what the content of vipassana is. It means seeing the truth and seeing that things are impermanent, suffering, and not self. So we can let go of them, seeing the Four Noble Truths, seeing conditionality, seeing the emptiness of things. So we know this is what we see when we see vipassana. But what do we see? What actually does it consist of? What is the actual experience? And it seems to me that there's no one thing that experience consists of, because it's an experience that consists of the emptiness of things, and so it's an experience which is actually quite open. And this is very much how these kinds of deep insights are conveyed in the Theragata and Therigata. Of course, the wonderful examples of just one example actually is from the Upadana Theri, where Bhadra Kundala Kesa, it's a very typical example. You know, she'd just been taught by the Buddha, and she was later praised by the Buddha as being the foremost bhikkhuni disciple in the swiftness of direct knowledge. The equivalent of his name escapes me at the moment. The in the seen there shall be only the seen, in the heard will only be the heard, and so on. A fellow whose name I should know, but anyway. Bhadia, thank you. So she's the female equivalent of Bhadia. And so she went back to her hermitage to her dwelling after getting teaching from the Buddha and washed her feet. And as she washed her feet and saw the water disappearing, and just in that little stream of water she saw rise and fall. And she was already a stream enter at that time. She was a stream enter before she ordained. So she already knew what rise and fall was. But just seeing it, then suddenly her mind's freed. And there's that depth of insight. So it's not like she didn't learn anything. She wasn't, she didn't kind of, find out anything that she didn't know already. But it's like that how do you see it? And this is the issue. And again, we were kind of talking about this on the retreat. Different approaches to developing insight. And I said, one of the approaches to developing insight was to go and get a rope, tie it around the branch of a tree, and then in despair, stand there, put the rope around your neck, and get ready to hang yourself. And then just as you're about to get off, then your mind's freed. But you have to really mean it. You can't fake it, right? And so, of course, somebody did that, again, according to the Therigata, and it worked. Right? They didn't do it deliberately. They weren't thinking, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to get my mind free. But you can't, nobody else can do it. You can't turn that into a system. Right? If you do, you certainly want to get some good public liability insurance beforehand in case of any mistakes along the way. But, maybe it would work. Maybe it would be a good system. Maybe that's what we should do here is we should, when we raise the ceiling, we can put some nooses up there and some chutes on the floor and get people ready. And but that, in that extremity, then something happens in the mind and the mind kind of opens up in a new way. And how do you explain that rationally? Well, you can't explain that rationally. And so you have to accept that there's these limitations on our knowledge and on our understanding. And any way that, any way to, in a sense, you establish like this positive doctrine of saying, well, the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths. He said to investigate the khandhas as impermanent, look at your sense bases and experience your sense activity, and then you see that the rise and fall in that and so on. So you have like a positive doctrine which we teach, which is like a content, but then it's also, it has this kind of leaking away from that. It's not a fixed and complete doctrine. It leaks out, and those leakages are very important, I think, and they're very useful. We shouldn't, and so this is something we have to, again, we just have to have that humility and a kind of acknowledgement of that we can't lock the truth up. We can't define, the truth in black and white or absolute terms. And if we did, it would be very dangerous. And is starting down that road to totalitarianism, as I mentioned before. So we always have to try to surprise ourselves. And Ajahn Brahm talks about doing this in, just to kind of break your habits. Instead of brushing your teeth, holding the toothbrush in your right hand, then hold the toothbrush in your left hand. And just you do little things like that, and that kind of challenges your habitual patterns. You have to sort of pay attention in a new way. And that's just a little way of doing it. But this is one thing that I think it is important. In what I've done, especially in the last few years, that in my life I've had to do many, many things which I would never have imagined that I'd do, or wanted to do, or depicted myself doing. And, but then sort of people say, oh, you should do this or do that. And so you sort of try it and learn. And you sort of put yourself in these kinds of experiences, And sometimes you enjoy it and discover things. Sometimes you think, oh, it's bloody horrible, I don't want to do that again. But you're always trying to challenge yourself and your image of yourself. And so this is why sometimes if we're too defined, we need this, we need that, these are the conditions we need, this is what we need for practice, blah, 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 and we're too defined, and then we're kind of trapping that into the world of what's happened in the past and into our ideas, and we're not experiencing what's happening now. But again, that has to be in balance, so I'm not saying that you shouldn't have those ideas. I'm just saying that there needs to be a certain flexibility and openness about them. Because they're not always going to work out in exactly the way that you think. So this was something that for me was very quite inspiring and quite empowering about the trip in Taiwan was I found that the tradition there had a more the places I went to had a more flexible perspective on the Dhamma than I'd seen normally in Theravada. But this is also remembering that I went to the best places in Taiwan, so this is not necessarily characteristic of all the places. I'm sure there's a lot of dogmatism and narrow-mindedness and so on, just as there is everywhere. But there was that kind of openness, but with a strong sense of integrity about it as well. So not just a kind of a wishy-washy universalism, but a definite sense of integrity and commitment. And certainly among the monastics, there's a much higher level of discipline in the monasteries I went to, in monastic discipline, than I've seen in Theravada virtually anywhere. I mean, of course, in terms of Patimokkha Sila, then they don't keep the Patimokkha rules, with some exceptions like Nanlin. They don't keep the Patimokkha rules the same way as the Theravadins do, but just in terms of the discipline of the lifestyle, is much stricter and regimented and so on than you find in, I've found in anywhere in Theravada. So that aspect of things is quite strong. But what impressed me more was the self-confidence and the inquiry, and it reminded me of, there's a line from Bob Dylan that if you live outside the law, you've got to be honest. And this was, I think, very true. And so for some of these groups and some of these people that I saw, they live outside the law. So something like Nanlin has sort of set itself up separate from the kind of they haven't followed the mainstream. They've done their own thing. They've designed their own robes. They have their own lifestyle and all of these kinds of things. So they're setting themselves apart from the customs of their local area. And then that demands this sense of integrity. And of course, you know, we saw the same thing in the forest tradition, that, you know, what Vajranan and so on did was to actually go against their own local traditions very strongly. And they were. This is like a major theme of the forest tradition, and you can still see this going as a living thing in the forest tradition today. You know, the wherever you go, for example, the forest monks are always whinging that the lay people are always trying to get them to go for funerals and funeral ceremonies, and you got to go. And it's not just you don't go for one; you got to go to the house before, and you got to come back to the monastery, and you got to go here, and you got to go to procession with the coffin, then you got to go here, and then you got to go burn the thing, and then you've got to do 7 days, and you go, and on and on and on and on. And so, you know, Ajahn Chah made this limit. You know, you can only do, I think they do 2 ceremonies. They would do one; they go to the house of the person, and then they do one when the cremation happens or something like that, that they only do, I think, twice, go and do some chanting. And this is a constant tussle. It's been going on for years. Another one I saw was quite interesting, once in northeast Thailand, and there was an argument between one of the monks and Lumpo Hom, and this old fellow, this old man in the village, one of the old village men, and the old village man was talking about ancestor worship. And so it was this classic conflict between kind of Buddhism and then the local kind of spiritual animist cultural beliefs, you know, and they were kind of arguing about it, and he was saying, oh, you know, you have to worship your parents to go to heaven or something like this. And then I couldn't understand a lot of it because it was in kind of dialect, but at one point Lumpo Hom said, so your mother and father were arahants, were they? And and he kind of sat there looking a bit like Mara, kind of scraping the ground with a stick and shoulders drooping, and the old fellow from the village was kind of, so this has been his theme, and it has to be that way. You know, the meditation traditions, you know, we see established, like very mainstream, like Mahasi traditions and so on, but they're also in their day were radically defying and going against the conventional wisdom, which said that, you know, it's impossible to attain the Dhamma in these times that we're living in, the declining age. To all these various prophecy texts in the Theravadin tradition or the Pali tradition, and we're living in the declining age, and you can't realize the Dhamma anymore. And then they radically went against that and focused attention back on the meditation practice. And so this is something which was, you know, we all must be incredibly grateful for that they did this. And so this process has to keep on going, and because it naturally ossifies, it naturally will fossilize. We've talked about this before. For example, another example being the Dhammayut tradition in Thailand. It started out being a critique of the Acharyavada, of the just following mindlessly what the teacher says without referring back to the Dhamma and Vinaya. And so the basis of it, as established by Prince Mongkut when he was a monk, was to critique the local cultural forms in light of what we know from Dhamma Vinaya. And that was the basis of it. And of course, you know, now 150 years later, that's exactly what the Dhammayut has become, very largely. That they is an instantiation of Thai cultural norms, royalist values, aristocratic values, and so on, which are reinforcing Thai nationalism rather than being a kind of a radical critique or questioning based on the Dhamma and Vinaya. So we can keep on finding examples like this. They happen all the time, and they will happen to us as well. So I was kind of thinking, well, what's going to happen after I go? And I kind of leave Taiwan, and then the next meditation teacher is going to come along, and they're going to find that all of the students who've been on Sujato's retreat all end up neurotic or something, and they're going to say, oh, this Sujato, what the hell are you doing? You know, all these people being on the all confused, they don't know what Theravada is and Mahayana now. They used to know what and now he's telling them that it's not what they thought, and they don't believe in Visuddhi Magga anymore, and what are we going to do? And so they're going to try to fix up all these broken people, and so I don't envy them their task. So we always have to be aware of this. How are we manifesting the Dhamma both internally and externally? And how hard that is to transfer. In some way, we need to transfer our Dhamma. There needs to be some internal and external Dhamma that happens on receiving. We hear, we listen, we learn, and also on giving, on sharing and communicating. And this is a dimension of our practice which is quite separate from meditation. Okay, it's not something which you can't meditate instead of doing these things. So you can't do right samadhi instead of doing right speech on the Eightfold Path, or right view, right mindfulness instead of right view. You have to do all of them, and everybody has to do all of them. There's no, you can't opt out of it. And they support each other, but they're not identical with each other, and they each address different aspects of our mind and different aspects of our spiritual practice. And so they're kind of this term that Ken Wilber uses. He calls them relatively independent domains or areas, which I think is quite a nice phrase. Relatively independent, not completely independent, not completely unrelated, but yet not totally interdetermined. And so this is why we can find that people when we understand this, and we can appreciate why people in different spheres can say different kinds of things. Like somebody can get very powerful, liberated, and at the same time have very regressive social views. You know, be very bigoted or biased or something like that, and that qualities actually do coexist. It's very hard to understand why that should be, but it's actual truth. It's an empirical fact. You know, it's not, you can't deny it. It actually happens. And so this is why we need to develop both of these sides. Just developing one side or the other is not going to do it. It's not going to be sufficient. So this is my little talk of reflection onto some of the Dhamma themes which had been occurring to me while in Taiwan, and sort of trying to just sort of get a feel for the Dhamma community in a kind of broader sense, and seeing the way that this worked, the dynamics of this through different communities and different places. So I offer this to you for your edification and entertainment, and if anyone has any comments or questions, you're most welcome.
I've had about the nuns that were at the previous monastery I was at. That was quite strict, but they were only salations. They were 10 years.
Ah, salations. Yeah.
But they were extremely strict.
Right.
They're very pure and morality.
Yeah.
And have very, very, I would say, very intense practice.
Yeah.
Many of them were very successful too.
Mm-hmm.
So I always admired the nuns there, because in some ways their life was more difficult than the monks. They didn't, their kutis, well, they're nicer now, but where they live is not nearly as secluded,
right.
And
right.
They don't have as many privileges as the bhikkhus.
Yeah,
they're very modest and very hardworking.
Yeah.
The other thing is...
The interesting thing about that is, again, this difference between the individual and the communal, because on an individual level, those things can actually be very useful. You know, the fact that you're not treated like somebody special, and that you're given a little kuti and all of this, I think it's actually a big obstacle for many monks in those countries, that they're treated with such veneration, that it's very difficult to try to evade the conceit and so on from it. So on an individual level, that can actually be good, but on a communal level, of course, then it leads to the degrading of the nuns as a community. So, the individuals can be very well practiced and very strong as individuals, but the community is not strong. So this is the interesting difference between those two aspects. Yeah.
Question I have is about the Buddha. Who was he was the most perfected of human beings. And yet, there was a situation where he advised a group of bhikkhus on a certain meditation practice.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of following his advice, they ended up committing suicide.
Yes, right. Yeah.
And I wonder how something like that could happen if, as his understanding of the human psyche was so deep and vast and profound, and yet even he, in advising people, I mean, I don't know if you could call it a mistake. I mean, maybe it was their karma that they would end up committing suicide.
Yeah.
And then he actually had to change their practice, but this was only after a number of them, according to Ananda, had actually committed suicide.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how something like that could have happened.
Yeah, it's very raises interesting questions, doesn't it? Yeah.
I mean, it raises a question about what you said. What's the word you use? Not absolutism.
The relativism.
Yeah, the way that people would take his teaching to such an extreme.
Yeah.
That they would end up killing themselves.
Yes, right. Yeah.
I mean, there's so many examples you see of a man who actually, when the Buddha said to cut off your sensual desires, he ended up cutting off a physical organ from his body instead.
Right. That's right, yeah.
Maybe it can't be prevented even by a Buddha. I mean, are that shallow? I don't know. How.
Yeah.
If he can't do it, then in all cases, then how can... even teachers who are not arhats do it. It just raises that question, and I wonder how you would answer that.
Absolutely. I think that kind of example is, you know, reminding us of that, just again that thing of being humble and acknowledging our own limitations. I mean, we can offer interpretations of that particular passage, but I don't know anyone who's offered a convincing one. I mean, there's a number of ways of looking at it. I mean, in a sense, it's one of those things where the message is clear enough. The message is, you know, don't just asubha kamatana and be too over the top with it, but, you know, balance it with, you know, Lumpo Panyawado at Ajahn Mahabua's vice abbot, English monk. And he sort of really paraphrased it very nice in his kind of English way. He said, you know, the Buddha said, yeah, if you want to do some body contemplation, but just make sure you do some anapanasati as well. So that was how he paraphrased it. And so as meditation advice, it's very good, very, very sensible. But as a story, it's very perplexing. Yeah, you wonder whether it actually happened, or whether it was a... Why would... If it didn't happen, then why would anybody invent the story like that? You can't imagine why they would make it up. It's not it's not kind of good propaganda for Buddhism or anything like that. Very curious, and it's got this very kind of dark humour about it, if you look at it as well, the way it's put in the vinaya. I mean, it's quite funny, you know. I mean, he goes away on retreat, and they're all slaughtering themselves, and they're hundreds, and the kind of the monastery attendant kind of comes and says, "Who wants to be sent over to the far shore? And let me send over." And so he sent over hundreds to the far shore. The monks were all slaughtered, and it was like a shambles. The Buddha was off on retreat at the time. Comes out of retreat and says to Ananda, "The Sangha looks strangely diminished, Ananda." And Ananda says, "It would be good, Lord, if the Lord were to teach a new kind of meditation to the monks." This kind of, you'd think that Ananda would have maybe gone to the Buddha earlier and said, "Bhante, sorry to disturb your retreat, but there's a bit of a problem happening in the Sangha, you know." Reflect on it.
So it's not
a missing knowing. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's pretty straightforward, but you'd think he'd... I mean, I don't think I've ever made a mistake that bad in teaching meditation, you know. I did have one person who committed suicide after I taught him, but that was probably not a result of my teaching, I know. But certainly not hundreds. Well, not hundreds. it's a very difficult, but again, I think the positive side of those things is that they do, it's like the kind of leakages I was mentioning, that they keep a questioning attitude towards it, because how can you come to a final or definitive interpretation of something like that? You know, you can explore it, you know, but you can't decide it, and that has its own value. Yeah.
I was a member of the Zen Center for 11 years, and there was a teaching there about a Japanese monk who had come to a kind of a, what would you say, a very pivotal place, crucial place in his life, and he decided that he lit a stick of incense and held it in one hand, and he had a knife in the other hand, and made a decision. When the incense burns down, if he doesn't get enlightened, he would kill himself. And the incense burns down, and at the very moment that it burns his fingers, he becomes enlightened. So I think possibly that story influenced a number of people at that Zen Center where I was at. But there were several suicides.
Oh, really?
One was directly a result of someone who went off into a desert and made a decision.
Really?
Yeah, he shot himself. And there was another who was the son of a teacher. And his teacher was very kind of like one of these, you know, very strict, you know, very strong in his teaching, you know.
Sit there and die sitting somewhere.
Yeah, a do or die kind of thing. And his son ended up slashing his wrists. So I've seen those kind of things happen, you know, maybe perhaps for the student misinterpreting what what these kind of teachings are. But those teachings, I think, can be dangerous. And subject to misinterpretation. But, I mean, that's an example, perhaps, of what you're saying. But, of course, that's not the original teaching of the Buddha anyways.
Right. Yeah, there are those kinds of extreme cases, but it's like in that hanging case, it wasn't a deliberate thing. You know, it wasn't saying, I'm going to, you know, get enlightened or hang myself. It was just that they were so depressed and in despair they decided to hang themselves. They weren't like doing it as a deliberate. And I think that's a very different attitude. You know, maybe these things are extraordinary. I think a lot of these things, when the teachers give very tough talks, and certainly my experience in Thailand was just that the monks and Thai people generally are just extremely relaxed. And they just hang, you know, they just sit around, and they have this uncanny ability to do literally nothing all day. I don't know if Burmese are the same, but the Westerners just can't do nothing. You have to meditate, do meditation, or do reading of a book, or do cleaning of your kuti, or do something else. The Thais are just, they could just do nothing at all. For hours, literally nothing. And they're just so relaxed and happy and stuff. And so the teachers then have to really, go on, get out of there, fight, get on, put some effort, go on, get out there, jump in the boxing ring and give those kilesas a good kicking. And usually we've tended to find that Western people don't respond so well to such teachings too much. Some people like them. A little bit is okay, but
meditation because of depression and anxiety, and whilst meditation will certainly, you know, give some sort of a lessening of the unsatisfactoriness, you know, I think people who are teaching meditation need to be very, very aware of, you know, how broken and, you know, some of their psyches are so shattered to begin with, you know, to be gentle with them, you know, to certainly prod them in the right direction, but also allow them to sort of develop some softness and gentleness, you know, within your own experience. I mean, if you look at empirical data on suicide intervention and prevention, up to 80% of people at some time in their life have thoughts of suicide. This is within Western context. So actually, thoughts of suicide are very quite common if everyone's actually honest in regards to, you know, life at times when you know, things go wrong, it can lead us into despair very quickly. And if you compile despair and lack of hope, thoughts of suicide can come up very, very quickly. And I know within my work with Lifeline, you know, most of my calls, I know it's people normally that call Lifeline. I've got a lot going on. But you speak to just normal, everyday people that are caught in loneliness and despair. You know, we want out, you know. Many people, you know, things happen, or myself, my own life, things go wrong, you know, and you think, oh gosh, there's got to be an easy way, you know, and you know, sometimes, you know, at different times in life, you'll think, oh, maybe that's the easy way. I mean, of course, now you know, with karma, and there's no easy way, you know, we're bestowed with dukkha, and unless we make our way through it, you know, that's the only escape, you know, but because I think people are so shattered in many ways, and as you said before, with the asubha techniques, you know, very, very effective, but make sure they're also joined, you know, with some practices like metta or anapana, where, you know, there can be a balance and some sense of relief and balm for the person that's really in a lot of pain. I mean, the mind is just so fragile.
Tash, please tell me if anybody rings Lifeline saying that they've been on one of my retreats. And but I want to know, okay? Yeah, you see kind of spike in suicide rates following one of Sujata's retreats. Yeah, you. I think with metta, you're pretty safe for the suicide front. You might find a few walls broken down in houses, but.
Why
would
you
just
use the door?
In a commentary?
Or that story? It's in the Visuddhimagga.
It's in the Visuddhimagga, so it was commentary.
Yeah. So they have a...
It's a strange story. I don't remember
any. Yeah, it was quite cute. And the Visuddhimagga has lots of kind of good stories. But it's just interesting to see that process of how things get canonized in that way. You know, like it's there in the Visuddhimagga. Why is it there in the Visuddhimagga? We don't really know. You know? Obviously, Guru Dosa thought it was a good idea to put it there, but what... The accepted tradition of the acharyas, or was it just something that somebody said at one time? And he thought, oh yeah, that sounds like a good example, I'll put it there. You know, or actually how did it come about? We don't really know. Yeah.